Tenor saxophonist Archie Shapp with Horace Parlin at the piano. That was Going Down Slow from their album of Blues, Trouble in Mind, which is on the Steeplechase record label. It's 24 minutes after 4 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WHYY 91 FM. And with me on Fresh Air is Timothy Leary, who, more than any other one person, was the father of the psychedelic movement of the 60s and its experiments with mind-altering drugs and plants. In 1960, Leary was invited to join the faculty of Harvard University at the Center for Personality Research to analyze the effects of psychedelics on personality. As part of his research, he turned on himself, kept diaries of the trips and how everyone reacted to the drugs, as well as how they felt they were changed by the experience. It was at Harvard that he met Richard Alpert, a colleague who became a close friend and a fellow proponent of the benefits of mind-altering drugs. One of his first visits to a prison was as a researcher, where he gave psychedelics to prisoners to see how it affected their mood and mindset. He later served close to 2 years in prison on a drug bust. He escaped prison and lived underground in Algeria, where he was to be assisted by Eldridge Cleaver and the Black Panther Network, but things didn't work out so well between them. Leary was eventually brought back to America, where he served out the remainder of his time. You'll also recall that Gordon Liddy raided Leary's house in upstate New York, where Liddy was an assistant DA before joining the Nixon administration. Liddy and Leary devote chapters to each other in their autobiographies and have even toured to debate on the lecture circuit. Timothy Leary has written a new autobiography. It's called Flashbacks, and Flashbacks is published by Houghton Mifflin. Timothy Leary, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Happy to be here.
Your initial experience or initial way of working with psychedelic drugs was as a researcher. What exactly were you trying to find out?
Well, I was a psychologist. In 1960, I had written a couple of books on psychodiagnosis and evaluation of psychotherapy, and I discovered what almost everyone else had discovered, that talk therapy just didn't change people. One-third get better, one-third stay the same, one-third get worse. The same thing happened if you talk to a bartender or the neighbor next door. So we were really looking around feverishly for some way to help people change their minds. And a friend of mine, a professor named Frank Barron, had told me about the mushrooms of Mexico, which seemed to alter consciousness, give you new perspectives, tap into new brain circuits. So in the summer of 1966, I had this experience, saw immediately that it does bring about changes in awareness. And we started what became known as the Harvard Psychedelic Drug Project. At the after 3 years, we had about 35 instructors, faculty members from the psychology department, from the divinity department, from MIT. And we turned on almost 2,000 people during this three-year period.
What was the turning point for Harvard where they decided that this wasn't such a good idea for them and they'd better disaffiliate with you?
Well, we all realize that the university, which is either tax-supported or, of course, Harvard University, it's a training school for the elite to go down to Washington or the Wall Street to run, you know, Protestant America. It's not fair to Harvard to have it become the experimental proving ground for a new form of psychology, which was to radically change our concept of human nature. And that's what we think did happen in the 60s. It was a return to the old notion of individuality, of looking within, doing your own thing. It goes back to Ralph Waldo Emerson, who's mentioned in Flashbacks as one of our heroes, who said self-reliance, who got kicked out of Harvard, by the way, in 1838 for saying pretty much what we said. We felt that, and it has, I think, been proven to be true, that the new version, the new vision of human nature is that you can evolve, you can go within, you can grow, inner development. All these notions would seem so cliche today. There are hundreds and hundreds of schools and gurus and theories to do it now. This was totally unknown when we started our research in 1960.
One of the people who you turned on during those early days was Arthur Koestler.
Yes.
Who you describe as being a very rational, logical, pretty humorless person. And after he got high, he said something like he didn't really believe in shortcuts to mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that statement now?
Well, I just parenthetically like to spend one sentence in praise of Arthur Koestler. I think he's one of the great intellectuals of our time. I think he's underestimated because he's, again, so far ahead. I think that history will treat him very kindly. I learned a tremendous amount about evolution and evolutionary theory from Koestler. Koestler was the first person to show that Darwinism is wrong. Darwin was right when he said we evolved, but he was wrong when we said it's blind evolution and it's chance. So that it was a great thrill to us when Koestler who had been a personal friend of mine, came to Harvard, and he got really far out there, and he was listening to the greatest music, and he was having. But then he said, "It's on the cheap. You got to sweat and suffer and toil to really get." And our answer to that was, "Well, you can have it both ways. It's not either or." He used the metaphor: to get to the mountaintop, you should struggle and carry a pack on your back and be sweaty and have sore feet. Then when you get there, you take your glass of schnapps. And I said, well, sure, Arthur, you can do that. But you could also go in a motor car. You can go in a ski lift. It's not either or. There's not just one way to the top of the mountain. And it's nice to go fast. It's nice to go on foot. It's nice to sweat. It's nice to lay back. So that was that's the chapter in my autobiography about Kessler. And most of the chapters in my book, as you suggest, by this question, raise some of these basic issues about how and when and why to use drugs to help yourself change.
My guest Timothy Leary's new book is called Flashbacks. How lasting in your own life did you find the peak high experiences to be? When you'd have a really good trip and would feel a very joyous experience and feel a very mystical experience, how much of it did it last, and how much was integrated after the trip ended?
That's a hard question to answer, because during a mushroom trip or a peyote trip or an LSD trip, your brain is zinging along at about a million miles an hour, and literally, if you've been high in grass, you know, you think an hour's gone by and it's only one half cut of a record. Because time distortion, you're simply experiencing so much that you think it's a long time, and it's not. Okay, I think the main thing you get from a mind-changing experience is the great discovery that there are many dimensions of reality, and that your mind can become a telescope, a microscope, an electron microscope. The peak moments don't last, but you don't want them to last. That's the great thing about sex, for example. You don't want to be walking around 24 hours a day, throbbing and pulsing and twitching and moaning and groaning in an orgasm. What's special about an orgasm is it's something that you kind of develop carefully and you plan for. Maybe your life's centered around it, but getting the nice kind of house and the flowers and the right partner and so forth. So that it was never our intention to promise or to hope for a permanent high. The brain, we now see, is a network of perhaps 40 billion microcomputers hooked up in a network. And there are infinite ways you can program and reprogram your brain. And there are times, when my airplane pilot tonight, when I'm flying to Boston, I don't want him to be hallucinating up there in the cockpit thinking about how grand the universe is. I want him to be, watching the runway. I don't want him high on grass, because I don't want him to be turned on by the pretty lights. I want him to be straight. On the other hand, I think he's a better pilot if on a weekend he has some way of relaxing and loosening up and getting a broader perspective than just being a robot pilot, because I think that boredom is what causes most crashes. So the idea of a permanent high or coming down is not never been our goal.
But I was asking, too, about the perspective that you'd have, the perspective of those different layers of reality. Would that stay with you afterwards?
Yes, and over the last 23 years since I started this research, I've written, I can't count them, but I know I've probably written 12 books about varieties of these experiences. And in most of my books, I've been working on a system of levels or stages of development, and we developed the notion of re-imprinting. And I think that you should think of your brain as this enormous computer room, and if you know how to do it, you can get your consciousness to go down to level 33 or down to level 22 and get out there, which is perhaps an earlier evolutionary or developmental or childhood level, and re-imprint, so that if you were afraid of snakes or dogs because you got bit by a dog when you were three, get on that elevator, turn your brain back to the age of three, and have a nice little cuddly puppy and have pictures of puppies and relive the terror, and then re-imprint, so that we're just now learning how to access the levels and circuits of the brain and to re-imprint and reprogram the realities that are stored there.
When you started turning people on in the early 60s, you would do it under pretty controlled circumstances. You were there to be a guide. You had done it a lot of times before and knew somewhat of what to expect. Of course, everybody would react differently, but you'd be able to understand their reaction, and if they're having a bad trip, to help them with it, and if they were having a good one, to, you know, help them enjoy themselves or develop whatever it was they were thinking about. When psychedelic drugs started spreading later on in the 60s, there were some people who had guides and other people who were really less informed about what to do and how to handle the new experience that they'd be having. What did you think about then? Like, what did you think about the multitude of people taking it, some of them not really understanding the power of the experience that was about to happen to them?
Well, we were, first of all, we were shocked to see that this was happening, and we were disturbed. Number one, of course, is the problem that they weren't taking LSD. There was no legal LSD in this country after 1966, so there are about 7 or 8 million people who took bathtub LSD or garage LSD or bootleg LSD, and if they were lucky, they got something that was reasonably good, but most of it was laced with speed or God knows what. This was a cause of tremendous concern to us. Now, as far as the wisdom of preparing yourself for a good trip, it's plain old common sense, and the same rule works, and we used to laugh, you know, we were writing these manuals. All right. You should know what you're doing. You should do it in a beautiful place. You should do it in a place where you're secure and comfortable. You should do it with people that you respect and love. You should do it with people that, if any worry comes along, will be able to guide you through it. Now, I'm not talking about LSD. I'm talking about life. I'm talking about making love. I'm talking about working. You should do all these things with this sense of preparation and setting and companionship. And you shouldn't do it alone, unprepared, in a strange place where the vibrations can be unfriendly or police can be around, whether you're going to make love or whether you're going to take LSD or whatever.
Did you have a lot of bad trips in your experiences?
Well, I've had many, many bad moments. We developed the concept of imprinting, which I've described in many of my books. And you come out of any experience like that with a new sense of reality, and you should... The concept of psychology we're developing is that of re-imprinting, that you... it's almost as though the way you'd make a movie, you plan the script that you want to live from, and you arrange... In other words, if your brain is a series of computers, you have to answer this question. Who has programmed your brain? And in most cases, the answer is accidentally in childhood. So that most of us are walking around kind of like robots, just in realities which have been imprinted accidentally in childhood. The concept of being able to re-imprint your realities is, I think, one of the most important concepts of the 20th century. It's implicit in the whole new philosophy that came out of the 60s, of taking charge of your life and being responsible for it and managing it in a more beautiful fashion.
I think a lot of the paranoia that some people experienced while they were tripping was because they knew what they were doing was illegal, and if they were found with the substance on them, the trip would certainly have a very bad ending.
That didn't help, and that was one of the problems. Was, until sex education and more liberal sex laws came along, that was true of most sexual activity. Most boys and girls or boys and boys that would go off or whatever, a generation before, were doing something nasty, dirty, and horrible, and God knows the neurosis, and people just simply weren't having good orgasms because they felt they were not only creating a sin, but it was against the law, and then, you know, on and on and on.
If you could write the drug laws now, what kind of laws would you write? And
well,
what would you take off the books altogether?
I think that the younger generation, those born between 1946 and 64, who are now between the ages of 18 and 36, are going to be rewriting the drug laws in the next 5 or 10 years when they take over, take control, take responsibility of running America. And I think there should be different rules and regulations for different kind of drugs. I think that, for example, hard liquor is much too easy to get. And I think that, the abuse of hard liquor, which is our number one drug problem, could be diminished if there was, like getting an auto license, that if it weren't so easily available and you had to demonstrate some sort of emotional control before you could just walk into a liquor store and for $8 get a a bottle of whiskey. I think, of course, education is the key to the use or the abuse of drugs, and I think that an enlightened government policy in which you knew you were getting good, safe drugs, and that you had to be licensed. I propose this in flashbacks. I describe, I think, three or four pages in which I went to Washington, D.C. and testified in front of the Teddy Kennedy Committee, in which I urged the government license people to take. Of course, when we talk about drugs, remember, I'm only interested in the psychedelic drugs. I have no interest in cocaine. I have no interest in heroin, PCP, and the tranquilizers that are so beloved by the American middle class.
Why aren't you interested in cocaine?
Why? Listen, I don't want to talk about drugs anymore. We should go right down the list. I really want to talk about the future. I'd like to talk a little more about the 60s as a historical. I think the 60s is an incredibly historical decade. I'd like to get into that if we could. I don't want to get down the list of drugs, really.
Do you see what happened in the 60s as having continuing impact now, or do you think that when the counterculture stopped existing as an obvious entity like that, a lot of what happened then changed or stopped or just became integrated into the mainstream?
Well, I think it's somewhat erroneous and misleading to talk about the 60s as though it was something that happened and it's over with. The real issue is the baby boom generation, those born between 46 and 64. Now, there's 76 million of you. That's 40 million more than we expected. 40 million more minds, bodies, more careers. Obviously, the grown-ups didn't count on this. That's why we're having an unemployment problem now. That's why we're having this sense of concern among young people, because society really doesn't need all of you. There are 40 million of you more than we had expected. Now, in the 60s, the baby boomers were just getting into the high schools and colleges. Like an enormous tidal wave, avalanche, you were moving through, and you were changing every cultural, social institution. You changed the schools, you changed the sex rules, you changed the music, you changed the dress. You changed the basic attitude in which, before you came along, your generation, it was all gung-ho. You worked for Ford, your job was to get up at 8 and work for 50 years and you get a gold watch and get Social Security. Your generation was the first one that came along that, after Hiroshima, you knew there couldn't be a World War III. You were exposed to television, so you knew about multiple realities and switching and dialing and tuning. You were the smartest, most affluent generation in history. In the 60s, there wasn't much you could do, though. That's why we said drop out. Drop out meant not just smoke grass and listen to the Beatles. Drop out meant change. Don't accept the old static routine. Get off the assembly line. Okay, now flash forward to 1988. In 1988, the baby boom, 76 million of you, will be between the ages of 24 and 42. The country is going to be in your hands. Now, to go back to your question, the 60s spirit is going to always live in those that went through the 60s. You know, you never get over your childhood, your adolescent imprints. That's why Frank Sinatra is so popular among 60-year-olds today. That's why Ronald Reagan wants to start the Spanish-American War all over again. That's exactly what Ronald Reagan is doing now, because he grew up when Teddy Roosevelt, that great military president, made his great career, you know, in a hill in Cuba. So Ronnie Reagan wants to redo the Caribbean War, because that's where the glory came from. The same thing is true of your generation. The notions of Woodstock and of the Beatles and sisterhood and brotherhood and freedom and peace and tolerance and hope, these are your blueprints, and you're indelibly marked by them. And when you get power, you're going to put these things into operation. So the 60s spirit is not over and dead. It's just now coming into its blossoming strength and glory.
That spirit that you're talking about, let me just reintroduce you first. Timothy Leary is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography, and it's called Flashbacks. That spirit of the 60s that you're talking about had a good deal of optimism in it, even though I think a lot of the counterculture was built around opposition to the Vietnam War. There was optimism that the opposition could be affected in changing things around. And, of course, the psychedelic experience added a lot of optimism to that as well. You went from that 60s experience to being in prison for a while and then having to live underground in Algeria and several European countries. What did that do to your spirit? Since it's such the complete opposite kind of experience that you were forced to live for several years than the one which you had lived before.
Yes, I was thrown in prison in January 1970, right at the beginning of the new decade. And until July 1976, which was our bicentennial, I was either in prison or on the run in exile. I didn't like this. I'm a red, white, and blue American, and I think America's the place to be. I hated to be. I hated exile more than I hated prison, really. I really don't want to. I'm not advocating prison, but I'd rather be in a California prison than in Algeria. If you're trapped in both places, and Algeria is a prison, you need an exit visa to get out. I found this period of imprisonment and exile to be fascinating. I learned a great deal. I liked change. When I found myself in the solitary confinement hole in Folsom Prison next to Charles Manson, you know, this is an experience that most Harvard professors don't get. I wrote about 7 books while I was in prison, did a lot of reading, a lot of thinking. I'm glad to be out, and I don't intend ever to get back in prison, but I felt no guilt, for one thing. And also, I always felt that it's the occupational hazard of a successful philosopher, that if your ideas are really stirring people up, if your ideas for change are unsettling the establishment, naturally they're going to put you in prison. So Copernicus, Galileo, Freud was run out of Vienna, Gandhi, you name me a great philosopher, and Socrates, you know, the Hemlock, Voltaire, they all had Rousseau, you name a philosopher, and you're naming a dissident. You name a great philosopher and you name a troublemaker, because that's what philosophy is all about. It's getting people to think new thoughts and think broad thoughts that the guys that run City Hall don't like. So for a philosophy major to end up in jail is not the shame that would come to a banker or to a politician, although some of them end up in jail too.
Some people emerge from the prison experience as a revisionist of their own past. And I'm thinking here of Eldridge Cleaver, who mm-hmm. who has completely changed his politics and changed religion. I think Jane Alpert, too, has changed her mm-hmm. politics in mm-hmm. a lot of ways. Did you ever consider doing that, of like revising your past in any way or completely changing what you believe in, becoming a different kind of person when you came out?
Well, no. Of course, I was never basically political. I think that Jane Alpert was wrong in her aggressive, violent militancy in the sense that she mellowed and became more feminist. I think that's a step forward. I don't think it's a reactionary step. I think it's an inevitable step. And she marched to the drummer of the time. So I think that was a... Now, when Eldridge Cleaver became a Moonie and went back to become a born-again Christian, I think, well, Eldridge is... I like him a lot, but Eldridge is a party line follower, and he'll whatever the party line is, he'll go along with it. I have not changed. I've not gone back on any of my beliefs. I still say in every college lecture, as I'm going to say right here in Philadelphia, that I don't think the government has any right to prevent me and my wife and my friends from changing our mood and changing our nervous systems. We can use any drug we want in the privacy of our own home, and I continue to do it, and I break the law continually in my own home because this is America, not Czechoslovakia. So I continue to just automatically restate my independence. I was brought up in 1920s when alcohol was an illegal drug. I was an Army brat. I lived at West Point as a kid, and my mother told me, and I have vague memories of all the officers who became, you know, generals later, Eisenhower and Bradley and MacArthur. They were all boozing it up, illegal booze, so that I've been through periods of illegal drug use so that I know that when the baby boom generation takes over in 4 to 6 years, they're going to legalize the drugs that my wife and I take. So I have not revised my position. I have grown. I'm much more interested now in talking about computers, video games, educational video games, than I am in drugs now. Drugs are kind of old hat to me now. I'm much more interested in the movie War Games as a real way to help younger generation turn on to the next level of intelligence, which is brain-computer link-ups.
What do you see that as being the next level?
Computers and video games? Well, there's a new generation that came along after 1964. These are the children of the baby boomers that we call them the whiz kids. They're the Spielberg kids, the E.T. kids. They're the first generation in human history that were consciously conceived, because the baby boomers were the first generation that had the pill where they had the courage to decide, I'm going to write my own life script, and we're going to postpone the baby until the wife finishes law school. Or we're going to postpone the baby until we take that trip around the world, or you know, whatever. So the whiz kids, those born after 64, are really, by and large, most of them, they're another species. Not just because they were wanted, because they've had the benefit of the baby boom generation's openness. And I have a 9-year-old son, and I have a 10-year-old grandson and 11-year-old granddaughter, and I spend several 8 or 9 hours a week with these kids over computers or studying video games with them, learning from them, and they're teaching me. And there's no question this is the next step in human evolution, and it is real time for optimism, I think, that we have two generations, your generation, baby boomers, and the whiz kids coming along. We're in good hands.
At the same time you're saying that, I know a lot of people are worried about the effects of video games on children and see it in the way that a lot of people used to see hanging out at the pool hall as being
like
the first step to juvenile delinquency.
Yeah.
What do you think of that, point of view?
Well, I think that it's totally a function of age and the extent to which you're committed to puritanical morality. It is true that many dictators in the world, including Marcos of Philippines, has banned video games. That figures. Anyone who belongs to a traditional, ancestor-worshipping, authoritarian society is going to hate video games. Why? Because kids can do them better than grown-ups. The Rubik's Cube was banned in Czechoslovakia because it showed up to the teachers. Anything kids can do better than grown-ups, the conservative grown-ups won't like. You know, there was a Gallup poll just about a week ago. It just made me laugh so much. They asked a silly question. They asked the question, do you like computers? And, of course, the predictable difference, totally on age. Those over the age of 55, 80%, almost 90% said they don't like computers. Now, how can you not like computers? But, of course, what they're really saying is, we don't like change. We don't like the future. We don't want anything that'll settle our old traditional ways of doing things. Whereas, excuse me, kids under the age of 25, like 90% of them love computers. So age is the key factor to predict, how a person's going to react. Kids that are in the video game part, of course, it's true. If you take 1,000 kids that play video games, there'll be 5 that do it too much. You know, they're always... No matter whether it's bicycling or whether it's, my God, you know, when the printing press first came along, you know, the Gutenberg allowed personal books instead of personal computers, you know, a book you can take home, but that's like a personal computer. There were a lot of moralists going around saying, those kids are wasting their time reading books and rotting their minds when they should be out there plowing or practicing sword fighting. It's the old story of whether you're in favor of change in the future or whether you're not.
About a year or two ago, you and G. Gordon Liddy were on the lecture circuit together, debating each other at colleges around the country. When he was an assistant DA in upstate New York, he raided your house and devotes a chapter to you in his book, as you devote a couple of pages to him in yours. What made you want to do that? I mean, this is a man who I imagine you really hate. I mean, really seriously dislike. I may be wrong about that.
You are very wrong. I don't dislike Liddy. As a matter of fact, I like him. I dislike his ideas, and I say flatly, he's a total authoritarian mind. He'll do anything his boss tells him to do, and he's total old-fashioned, macho, militarist, police-type thinker. I think his ideas are dangerous and un-American, and I try to do everything in my power to expose the fallacy of his ideas. On the other hand, there are a lot of people that agree with him, and he's speaking for a large group of old-timer Americans. Now, I don't dislike Liddy. Liddy plays the game, you know, fairly. I admire him as an enemy, because he's smart, he's articulate, and if I can defeat him in public, I'm often preaching to the converted, you know, preaching to the choir. You know, my fans come out and they want to hear me talk about the future, rah-rah computers, rah-rah drugs, yeah. But when I can have half a Liddy audience there and I can show a lot of neutral people, or a lot of people are just, hey, there's a circus in town. These two wild guys are here. Let's go look. If I can convert them and show them how Liddy is using techniques of mass hypnosis and brainwashing and double talk, the same double talk that Reagan is using.
Do you think it works? Do you convert people, or does everyone come back reinforced with what they already believed when they walked in?
Well, I'm getting better at it. Yes, I think that, I think I'm making points.
We started this conversation talking about your work at Harvard when you were interested in using psychedelics in a therapeutic setting. You still interested in that idea? Do you think that it could be used therapeutically?
Yes, there was a conference in Santa Barbara last May. That's just a month ago, just 2 weeks ago, actually. This is the second annual conference which was held there. Large crowds of people came out, and it's on the scientific and the philosophic aspects of LSD, and they were the top names in the field. There's a sizable, respectable coterie or army of LSD researchers who are doing LSD research right now, even though it's illegal, and some of whom are lobbying to get the laws changed. The therapeutic use of LSD is going to continue and will explode. Also, there are a lot of new drugs. There's a man named Sasha Shulgin from Berkeley, California. He's a very respectable scientist, and he's developing several families of mind-changing drugs. Now, they're not illegal because, number one, he writes about them in academic journals, and he only gives them to people who are experts in the field. Like my wife and I have the good fortune to have access to these drugs. Why? Because he knows they're like test pilots and that we can give him back results of how they work on us and so forth, so that you're going to have many new drugs developing, which will be used. These are already being used in San Francisco and Los Angeles area by modern, more avant-garde psychotherapists, because they are drugs that produce intense clarity, that a person may be frozen or distorted by anxiety or fear or anger and can't see clearly. And these drugs put you in a state of just intense, euphoric empathy for yourself, for other people, with absolute diamond-pure clarity. Now, I'm not talking about LSD, wild, computerized, graphic, Disneyland, cosmic spectaculars. I'm talking about just absolute razor-sharp diamond clarity and compassionate understanding. Well, naturally, this is a boon to psychotherapists who are trying to get their patients to kind of calm down and see things clearly. So, yes, the use of drugs, brain-change drugs in the field of personality change is just beginning. We're primitive savages, and in the next 5-10 years, you're going to see a lot more work, better work, coming out of the laboratories.
We're about out of time, but there's one last thing I was wondering. People always speculate about what the effects are of taking a lot of psychedelics, and probably you're one of the best equipped people in the country to respond to that. You've probably done more than nearly about anybody else has. People always wonder, if their memory loss is a result of drugs that they've done or whatever. You know, what do you think? Judging from your own experience, do you have any physical or psychological? I'm not talking about spiritual things.
Yeah, it's impossible to answer that question. I'm 62 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the most active 62-year-old you'll ever find, and I've just got a best-selling book out, and people can read that and judge for themselves. I don't know what I'd be like if I hadn't taken drugs, so it's hard to say. I must tell you this, and anyone who's listening to this program should listen carefully to what I'm saying now. Although I have tremendous courage and almost no stress or fear, I've been very cautious. I've taken maybe LSD maybe 1,000 times, but I've always known where that drug came from. I would never take a drug that I didn't have the pedigree of. I would never take a street drug. I've turned down thousands of mushrooms and plants and strange little capsules and funny little pills. I will never take anything unless I know, nor will I take any drug unless it's in the circumstances which are absolutely serene. And I'm very conservative about when and where, although I am very courageous and will take anything. If a friend of mine is a pharmacologist and says, try this, I'll try it. But prudence and intelligence is a way to live long and happily, and I wish it all to your audience.
Well, with that, we're out of time, and I want to thank you very, very much for speaking with us. Thanks for being here.
Great pleasure.
Timothy Leary has been my guest, and he's written a new book, which is an autobiography. It's called Flashbacks, and it's just been published by Houghton Mifflin. The name of the book, again, is Flashbacks. It's a minute and a half to 5 o'clock. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air in just a minute, but let's check in first with shadow traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Northbound Roosevelt Extension, a good 35-minute delay to travel between the Twin Bridges through the detour back onto the boulevard at 9th Street, all due to an earlier disabled tractor-trailer. I-95 northbound slows for 3/4 mile approaching the Ray Street merger, also some slow volume at the Woodhaven off-ramp. Southbound 95, a 9-minute delay off the Girard Point Bridge down to the Platte Detour Road at Island, and westbound 291 is slow approaching Bartram due to a disabled vehicle in the left lane in the process.